Let's turn our Bibles over to Matthew, Matthew chapter 28. In just a minute, we'll look at Matthew 28, verses 11 through 15. We're talking about some women, and they were in different groups, at least two groups, going to see Jesus' tomb. We've talked about that a little bit. We've got Mary Magdalene going back and reporting to the apostles. We have in Matthew chapter 28 and verse 10, some women that show up to Jesus. This is after Mary Magdalene has had a chance to hold on to the Lord for a little bit, and Jesus has sent her away, don't cling to me. And then you've got some other ladies that show up and they worship him, verse 9 of Matthew 28. And then we're going to head over now to verse 11 and read down through verse 15 of Matthew 28. Now while they were going, behold, some of the guard came into the city and told on the chief priests all the things that were come to pass. And when they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel, they gave them much money unto the soldiers, saying, Say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept. And if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and rid you of care. So they took the money and did as they were taught. And this saying was spread abroad among the Jews and continueth until these days. Let's think about the guards. As you go back in time a little bit, this will be back in Matthew chapter 28, verses 3 and 4. You have them appearing for a time, do you remember, as what? As dead men. Remember that? They are incapacitated. They're simply overcome. And from what we know, there was only one angel that showed up. It is this angel which has a lightning-like appearance, and it just, you know, scares the pants off these fellas. Well, at some point, they recover. They recover enough where they can get on the move again, and they leave their post. That's significant. As we look at Matthew 28, back there in verses 10 and 11 that we highlighted a bit ago, you have some women, they show up to meet Jesus, and as they're going, you have the guard. And again, we've talked about the fact whether or not these were Romans or Jewish guards in the past. I favor the Roman guard for a number of reasons. You have the guard, they're going into the city, and who do they seek out? They seek out their commander? No, they seek out the chief priests, and also they're looking for the elders. And if the guards were Roman, would you say that seems to be a little odd? If the guards were Roman, do you think it would be odd to seek out these Jewish officials?
Yeah, they're going out of
the chain of command. Yes, I mean, not just outside the chain of command, but they're going to a different group of people. You would think that they would have reported to a Roman commander and said, look, something bad has happened. Maybe this is shrewdness on their part. Or it might be that they're thinking, there's been the earthquake, there's been this angel, and there's been some other stuff that's really unusual. And this Jesus guy was religious in the first place, and because of all the stuff that's happened, logically it makes sense to go see who? Let's go see the religious people. In this case, you have the people listed who would have been involved with the Sanhedrin. So I'm not sure that all the Sanhedrin was assembled. We certainly know that not all the soldiers were assembled, because it says some of them. When you think about the soldiers, when they came to life again, if you will, they weren't dead, but when they finally regain their senses and they're able to function, we don't know how many went. We'll use a passage a little bit later to indicate that maybe there were 16 of these guys, but whether you have maybe 8 or 12 or 16, what do you imagine when these guys came to their senses? What happened?
We're in big trouble.
Yes, and after they came to that conclusion, as far as deciding where to go, what do you think might have happened there? When you have a situation today when there's chaos, think about what's going on in Florida as far as the volcano. When you have the eruption.
Hawaii.
Huh?
Hawaii.
Or what did I say?
Florida.
Florida. How about that? I was. All right. Wrong direction. All right. Thank you. All right. Hawaii. At least we know we've got some people listening. Hawaii. You see the big eruption. You've got some people down there. What do people think? Right, run, scatter, get out of there. And you may not find that everybody says, hey, follow me. It's every man for himself. And I think as you look at the guards, that might have been exactly what you're finding there. It's, you know, we got to run. You know, we're able to function again. So some decide they're going to run to the guards. Others may have gone to other places. Maybe some went home. Maybe some just fled and didn't give much thought to where they're going. So that to me is the picture, at least the image that I get. So they go, at least some of them, They meet with the elders, the Sanhedrin, and as you imagine the Sanhedrin meeting, getting the report from at least some of the soldiers, how intense do you think the discussions would have been among the Sanhedrin? I think it probably would have been fairly heated. Because as you're batting this back and forth, you have only two possible conclusions, don't you? What's conclusion number one?
Somebody stole the body.
Well, okay. Somebody stole the body. Or he really did raise from the dead. And they would not have liked either one of those conclusions, especially the idea that that Jesus had been raised from the dead. So they come to the first conclusion that someone had stolen the body. And to encourage the soldiers to support that story, what do they do? They say, hey guys, we've got not just some money, we have how much money for you? We've got a lot of money. And that's a question which I'd like answered as well. How much was a lot of money? 6 months' salary? A year's salary? Maybe 10 years' salary? We don't know. But this was a significant sum to encourage these soldiers to say what? If they ask, Jesus' disciples came when? By night. And what do? They stole his body while you guys were doing what? While you slept. Well, that explanation doesn't line up at all for a number of reasons. First of all, we would say, if you're asleep, do you know what's taking place? No. So that's problem number one. There was nothing like a security camera to review the evidence. Let's take a look at Acts chapter 12. This is one of the passages that I wanted to review. We could also head over to Acts chapter 16, but Acts 12 will be sufficient. We'll look at Acts 12, 6 and 7, and then we'll jump down to verse 19 to get the basic context. I don't think we have to read all those verses. But Acts 12, 6 and 7, Steve, we'll start with you, and then also have you hop down to 19.
And when Herod was about to bring him out that night, Peter was sleeping, bound with two chains between two soldiers, and the guard before the door were keeping the prisoner. Now behold, an angel of the Lord stood by him, and a light shone in the prison, and he struck Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, "Arise quickly," and his chains fell off his hands.
Thank you. Now, in just a minute, we'll ask you to read verse 19. So Peter's being guarded. Again, we are not told exactly who the soldiers here as far as their background. Rome, to me, seems to be the most likely culprit as far as the people who are doing the guarding. But he's being guarded, and he escapes. Let's look at verse 19 now.
When Herod had reached for him and not found him, he examined the guards and commanded that they be put to death. And he went down from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there.
Okay. Guards, you let this guy go. What's he thinking? You need to be punished, and the punishment's going to be? You need to die. That's how it worked. So when we
stick around so nothing was going to come back on him.
Yeah.
Or at least put some distance between him and the situation.
Sure.
He didn't stick around.
So when we look at what we have in Matthew chapter 28, it seems like death would have been the likely outcome as well. When you look at guards, how that was done in this day and time, there very well may have been 16 guards. Again, could have been less than that. But as significant as this was, probably better to have more than less. If you do have at least 4 guards or 8 guards or 12 guards or 16 guards, do you think it's likely that all these guards are going to be asleep at the same time? Probably not too likely. And then when you look at the fourth point, remember the stone that we described in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 60? If you back up one chapter, you would find that the stone is described as a great stone. And then if you were to look at Mark's account of this, this would be in Mark chapter 16 and verse 4. Mark refers to the stone as exceeding great. Anybody remember the amount of weight that I gave as far as an estimate? Yes, more than 2 tons, probably close to 2.5 tons. That was an estimate that was come up with by some engineers. So I'm going to trust their estimate. And then do you remember what we said? This is based on John chapter 20 and verse 1. The stone wasn't simply pushed aside. You remember from John 20 and verse 1 what it says about the stone? All right, it was basically picked up and moved away. So it's one thing to take a 2.5 ton rock and get it to the side. But if you're taking a 2.5 ton rock that probably would have been 4 or 5 feet tall, remember they stooped to get into the tomb, and actually moving that you're not going to sleep through that. That's going to get a great deal of attention. So maybe even in God's providence, the size of the rock factored in here. When you think about the disciples, Matthew chapter 26, verses 55 and 56, backing up two chapters. Less than 72 hours prior to this time, remember, you have the crowd coming against Jesus. They've got the staves, they've got the clubs and so forth, and they're there with the torches, and Jesus says, "Who do you want? We're looking for Jesus in Nazareth." What did the disciples do? I mean, Peter pulls out the sword, but it doesn't take very long for his bravery to flee. And what happens with the Lord's disciples? Stand and fight? The Bible says that they forsook him and fled. And now the idea is that they came and took the body. Matthew apparently believed that the theory being floated here in Matthew chapter 28, verses 11 through 15, was so far-fetched, he mentions it, but he doesn't comment on it. Now let that sink in. He mentions the idea that was being circulated, but he doesn't comment on it. Well, the Sanhedrin, as you look at this, they gave the soldiers a lot of money, and with that money that we mentioned earlier, they also give them a promise. And what's the promise? If what happens? If this comes to the governor's ears, if Pilate hears about it, then what are we going to do? We're going to
cover up for you.
We're going to take care of it. We're going to rid you of the care. That ridding, the word that is used there, describes something like keeping you out of trouble. That is, this situation would be dangerous. We pointed that out from Acts 12. Remember, you need to die. You let the prisoners escape. And now you're not going to have any worry about that. But sleeping on duty was something that would take the lives of people. Now, it's kind of interesting. Remember back there in Mark chapter 14, verses 43 to 45? Before Pilate releases the body, what's he do? Ray?
He asked if Jesus is actually dead.
Yeah. And not only does he ask, is Jesus dead, who does he ask?
Centurion.
A centurion. This had never dawned on me in 30 years of preaching and teaching. It did dawn on me as I was headed down to a preacher's meeting. Ray was there as well. And I mentioned this to the guys because about three of us had served in the military. We've got a few others in here tonight that have served in the military. The highest enlisted rank, generally speaking, is an E-9. Now, you can kind of become the chief master sergeant of the Air Force or probably the chief master sergeant of the Navy or Marine Corps. They've got some special slots that would probably take you to Washington, D.C. But basically, the highest enlisted rank that you can have is an E-9. And Ray was there, and he was talking about the fact that he's on this submarine many years ago. And he said out of all the people on the submarines who were E-9s, there was just one guy. If you find an E-9, an E-9 is someone, Don, you probably remember him too, don't you? The E-9s, and Stan, you can comment on this if your experience was a little bit different. But the E-9s are placed in select groups. You don't find too many of them. But they are put maybe outside a base commander's office, or they're put in a squadron office. And these guys, they definitely know how to take a firm hand. But at the same time, as you deal with them, in a lot of circumstances, it's almost like they have a somewhat grandfatherly approach. They've seen the heat of battle likely, and they've experienced some very difficult things, and they're probably going to be people that you would enjoy talking to because of their experience and just because they seem to have a well-rounded personality. They're probably not going to be real radical. They're probably not going to be people that you're going to dread seeing unless you've done something really bad. But for the most part, they're really good folks. And I think as you, if you've ever been in the military and you can imagine what an E-9 is like, and a lot of guys who have served would say, oh yes, I know what that rank is like. You then have a better appreciation for what I think centurions were like in the first century. Now, we'll let you guys comment that have served in the military if you want to do that. But let me take that and make that point in light of Mark chapter 14. Pilate doesn't ask just any soldier. It's not the private. It's not the sergeant over here that he's asking. But when you ask a centurion, is the guy dead? Who are you asking in light of what I've just described?
The guy in charge.
I want a guy you trust. I mean, this guy doesn't rise to that position overnight. In our military, you're probably not going to reach that rank before you've put in at least 18, 19, 20 years. And it might require you to go beyond 20 years. I mean, it's a very special rank. So if you're asking the centurion, you can have absolute faith, absolute confidence, perfect trust in this fellow. Now, let's take that and go back to where we are in Matthew chapter 28. If this comes to Pilate's ears, we'll take care of it for you. How much interest do you think that Pilate had in trying to go back and revisit this issue? Likely not a lot. Because does he have any worries about Jesus being crucified? I mean, he's talked to what probably was going to be the right-hand guy. One of the guys, I mean, that he's got absolute faith in. I know the guy was dead. So whatever happened, hey, you know, I've got other stuff and I don't want to deal with this Jesus guy anymore. It was tough enough getting him killed. So just you guys go ahead and take care of it. So the Jews may have been thinking that as well when they come and they start talking to the soldiers about this. Don or Stan or anybody else? Bob, anybody else want to mention something about an E9, an experience that you had?
You better well cover it. They were like a grand. I remember the last 6 months I was in, there was an E9 right under the company commander. He was a nice guy.
Yes.
I remember seeing all those strategy, a tree on top, a tree on the bottom, and a diamond in the middle.
Yeah.
But he was a very nice guy.
Yeah, a lot of times, like I say, a first sergeant or whatever that would be equivalent to in some other branches, and they were really good at troubleshooting. Just kind of come up and, you know, put an arm maybe around you and say, hey, you know, this can be taken care of. But good illustration for a centurion. That it? All right, let me make this point as well, which you may not have been aware of. But you do have some people who obviously have had an interest in Christianity throughout the years. There was one fella, a guy by the name of Justin Martyr. And he's living about 150, 170 AD and doing some writing during that time. So it's about 120 years or so after Jesus' death. And he wrote, he claimed that the Jews used special messengers to disperse this story that we're reading about in Matthew chapter 28. They used special messengers. They sent them throughout the world. Now think about that. They're sending special messengers throughout the known world to say, oh, hey, that Jesus character, he didn't die. His disciples came and stole the body. So this was not something that was just local in the area of Jerusalem. This was a big, big deal. Why would the Jews have done that? I mean, that surely cost them some money. If you're going to send out orators to make some presentations, do you want the guy who is the slouch? Who do you want? You want the best communicators, right? And if people know that you need the best and they would fall into that bracket, guess what? They're not going to come cheap. Why would the Jews have done that? Sending out people throughout the known world to say, oh, this Jesus character, if you hear about him, he wasn't raised from the dead. Why do that?
Save face.
Well, I think that's part of the answer. Anything else?
Well, ultimately, they're trying to save their position.
And their religion.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a threat. If you have someone who has been raised from the dead and he's the Messiah, your religion is going to tank. So you're willing, I think, to pay for the best of the best and do everything you possibly can. So imagine for more than 100 years, from what we know, if that historical piece of information is accurate, the Jews are trying to dissuade people from believing in the resurrection of Christ. There's an old line, isn't it, from Shakespeare? She protests too much. What happens when the person protests and protests and protests? I didn't do it. I didn't break the lamp. Sure wasn't me. After about 25 denials, what are you thinking? Well, I think you're my prime suspect. You've just denied too much. And for the Jews, they likely overplayed their hand. And I think that God would have taken care of that regardless of what they would have done. But still, it's amazing. Anything that you want to add or ask before we head over to a quick point from Luke chapter 24 and verse 34? Okay, let's see what we've got in Luke 24. This is some information about Peter. It ties in with what Paul had to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 5. It's a very quick point as we're looking at the chronological record of what took place, though. It's also a point that we don't want to miss. Luke 24:34. Anybody want to read it?
Saying the Lord is risen indeed and hath
appeared to Simon.
Okay. We don't have a lot of information about this appearance to Peter, but it's not difficult to understand. Why select Peter for a special appearance? Or why emphasize, by Jesus, I'm going to see Peter?
Because he denied him.
All right. And not only had he denied him, how powerful, how strong had been the denials been? Yeah. And not that he's saying bad words, but he rains down curses upon himself. May I be cursed. I vow that I do not know the man. And that would be back there in Matthew chapter 26, verses 33 through 35. And Jesus, of course, had made the point about the cock crowing. Peter was going to deny him three times. I think, and there may be some other reasons for this, but by selecting Peter, as far as Jesus saying, I'm going to appear to this man, let him know that I've been raised from the dead, it was a way of saying that all is forgiven. Paul thought that this was significant enough that he mentions it in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 5. Switching gears just a little bit, it's been said that there were three key E's as far as items occurring within less than 40 hours of Jesus' death. When we think about Jesus' death, we've got him probably spending about an hour in the tomb on Friday. You have a full 24 hours, that would be on Saturday, and then likely about 12 hours on Sunday. The three E's are these. Number one, there was early testimony. Sometimes people will say, well, we've got a story to tell, and it takes a little while to get the story figured out. You see that in politics sometimes. Somebody will say something, well, I didn't mean that. And then they come out with another version, and then they come out with another version. And finally, after about a week or a month or a year, they've cleaned it up to the point where people say, well, that's not credible. But that's not what we have here. Early testimony. And then do we have eyewitness testimony? I mean, we've got the women. We've talked about the fact that they were not highly regarded. That was very unusual by God, but we've got eyewitness testimony by a number of people. The soldiers, how much they saw of the resurrection, we don't know, but certainly the angel spooked them big time. And then we've also got the 30, that would be the empty tomb. So we have this early stuff taking place in what area? Close to what city? Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was going to be a hotbed or not a hotbed. I mean, that's where the opposition to Jesus was, and it was the most hostile environment to the Lord's resurrection. We've also got the wide variety of witnesses. Thousands of people began to become Christians, and nobody's able to offer a sensible explanation for the resurrection. So, again, everything lines up for a lot of people to become Christians. Now, there are some people throughout time who have made some interesting claims. There is, for example, one person, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce the name, but he contended that Jesus actually fled to India. To this day, I'm giving you a quote from Strobel in his Case for Christ. There's a shrine that supposedly marks his real burial place in Kashmir. You also have, and this is kind of an interesting and really strange reference in the Quran, in Surah 4, that would be like chapter 4, verses 157 and 158, there is a reference which essentially says, and it's a passage that Muslims don't like to discuss very much, but the Muslims would say essentially that God took him, that Jesus didn't die. And that's their explanation to get around Jesus' resurrection and even his death. God just, you know, kind of translated him, transported him, and took him. So there was no death, and if there was no death, there can't be no resurrection. So people have made all kinds of interesting claims, and they're not very hard to refute. Still, you have to deal with the empty tomb. Anything that you want to add or ask before we head over to Luke chapter 24? Okay, let's go over to Luke chapter 24. You do have this reference just a bit in Mark's account, not very much. Mark chapter 16, verses 12 and 13. Luke's account, though, is going to be our primary one. Luke chapter 24, starting with verse 13. And this goes down to about verse 35, but let's just read a few verses and take it little by little. In verse 13, the paragraph breaks in the ASV, so if you don't have a paragraph break, just try to make one mentally. And behold, two of them were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, which was 80 furlongs from Jerusalem. And they communed with each other of all these things which had happened. And it came to pass, while they communed and questioned together, that Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were holden that they should not know him. We'll stop at 17. And he said unto them, what communications are these that ye have one with another as ye walk? And they stood still, looking sad. Emmaus was not far from Jerusalem. It was a little village. It was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And you have here Luke saying on the day of his resurrection. Well, what day would that have been? The day of his resurrection was Sunday. So Jesus is busy. There are two guys who are walking to this village. That's in verse 13. And Jesus appears to these two fellows, and he's speaking to them. They're speaking, rather, about all the things which had happened. That's Luke chapter 24 and verse 14. So as they're involved with this discussion, and we're going to see a little bit later that it was very intense, Jesus comes near, and he begins to go with them. That's also in verse 15. Did these fellows recognize who Jesus was? No. There may be a similar incident to that, similar incidents to this back in Numbers chapter 22 and verse 31, some information about Balaam. Jesus, in Mark's parallel account, that would be Mark chapter 16 and verse 12, he was in a different form, and maybe that's what prevented them from understanding who he was. And then Jesus, this is rich, he asked these fellas, verse 17, hey, what are you guys talking about? Well, do you think he knew? Yeah, I think he knew. And then after that, you have the word communications. And that's a key word. Anybody have there in verse 17 some other words besides communications?
Conversation.
All right, conversation. Anything else, Carol?
Exchanging words that you were exchanging with one another.
Okay, that's going to get us a little closer. Anybody else?
Matters you were discussing so intently.
All right, that's even better. You were discussing these things intently. When you have an intense discussion with someone, or you're discussing things intently, what kind of conversation can that be?
Loud.
All right, it might be loud. That may or may not have been true here. We don't know. But that's one possibility.
Emotional.
All right, it might be emotional. So we've got the volume. We've got maybe passionate emotion involved. What else?
Animated.
All right, people might be talking with their hands. Anything else?
Private.
All right, there's that. The word that is used here, it's a preposition with the Greek word balo. And the word balo means to throw. Have you ever had a conversation where you were throwing things back and forth?
Sure.
Well, that I think is interesting, but then you throw in the preposition, anti. And anti means I'm anti-smoking. I'm for it or against it?
Yes.
I'm against it. So anti, against, and you got this idea of throwing things back and forth. One source said this, and I like the definition. He said it indicates a fervent or excited exchange of words and idea, perhaps even some disagreement. So think about that. Jesus, all this stuff over the last 3 days. And this is a snapshot of just these two guys. And you begin to wonder if perhaps this kind of thing was not taking place all over the city of Jerusalem. I think that's probably likely. But at least with these two guys, they are involved. Were they friends? We don't know. But these two fellows have come together and they are having this impassioned discussion. They're throwing things back and forth. You might be thinking in terms of, well, was he this prophet? Or was he the Messiah? Or what was he going to do? I thought he was going to do this. And those kinds of conversations can be very, very interesting. At the end of verse 17, the text says that these men stood still, and they were looking how? They were looking sad. Now, let's see. The word sad is only used twice in the New Testament. The other time is back in the book of Matthew. And it's kind of a strange passage, but if you see what's said there, as far as how that word is used, I think it helps you understand a little bit the sadness here. Let's go back there, Matthew 6 and verse 16. When somebody gets it, let's see who wants to read it. Matthew 6, 16. All right, Gary's got it.
Moreover, when ye fast, be not as the hypocrites of a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear unto men to fast. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward.
Okay, they disfigure their faces. Do you think they put on all, you know, the stuff that they needed to look nice before they go out in public? What did he mean? They disfigure their faces. Instead of looking happy, they come out looking sad. They come out looking gloomy. They come out looking like, you know, I've just had the worst day of my life. I've received some very bad news. If you know what that word means in Matthew 6:16, then as you come over to Luke chapter 24, same word. What do you see about these guys? They are gloomy. They are dejected. You perhaps might be able to use the word discouraged. Maybe they are despondent. And that's kind of an interesting picture, isn't it? Here they have those kinds of feelings, cast down, burdened a little bit. And yet, what are they still doing? Antibalo, they're still going back and forth. They're having this great discussion between the two of them. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say a little bit more? Okay. You have one of these fellows. He's named Cleopas. We don't know any more about him. Only time he's mentioned in the New Testament. And Jesus has now engaged them. And what does he say to the Lord in verse 18? You must be what?
A stranger.
Yeah. And why does he make that point?
Because Jesus said he wanted to know what they were talking about.
Yeah. Are you the only guy in Israel or in Jerusalem and you don't know the things which are come to pass when? In these days. There's this Jesus character. He was arrested, and the chief priests, the Sanhedrin, they get things worked up and they call for his death, and he's out there, he's crucified, and we just didn't know what was going to happen, and now everything seems like it's a big bust. How can you not know what is taking place? You ever had to bite your tongue? I wonder if the Lord didn't have to bite his tongue as he was listening to these guys. So the Lord, you see this a little bit more in verse 19, he says, hey, what you guys talking about? Quick point. If you know the answer to a question, are you necessarily required to admit that? No. Did Jesus know what these guys were talking about? Yes. I mean, he was at the center of it. He knew exactly what was taking place. So here again, we have a point that we've made multiple times in multiple classes. God sometimes, quote unquote, asks for information. That does not mean he does not know. But sometimes that is designed to get information. And it really is, you just have to smile at that and almost laugh. And he said unto them, oh, what things? He must have had a sense of humor. All right, well, after Jesus has feigned ignorance, we might say, what do these guys do? They just kind of sit back, or do they launch into a big discussion? They told him. He asked, and they are ready to go. And they, so we know that it's both of them, they explain how Jesus, the Nazarene, was a prophet. And notice this, you have two, we might actually say three here, but he's mighty in two things. He's mighty in deed. What would you say that refers to?
His miracles.
All right, his miracles, the signs that he did. And he's also mighty in word. What do you think they were saying by that?
Scriptures.
All right, if you listen to this fellow Jesus teach, he really was able to put the meat on the table.
It's like Nicodemus said.
Yes.
No man has ever spoke like this
before. Yeah, we know that you're a teacher from God because of what you're doing and the sayings, it just can't be matched. There's no other person that speaks in this way. And then they go on to explain how the chief priests and the Jewish rulers, the Sanhedrin, had delivered up the Lord to be condemned to death and crucified. Luke chapter 24 and verse 20. Here again is an interesting point. You find today people, all kinds of people, sometimes politicians, they will do something. Do they think they can cover it up? Yeah. We don't know if the Sanhedrin was all that interested in covering things up or not. I suspect that the less that people knew about it, the happier they would have been. But that's where you get the scandals and the investigations. People do something and they hope that they can hide it. And in this case, it wasn't hidden. All right, what was the hope of these men and surely many others? They thought that Jesus would do what for Israel? They thought that he would redeem Israel. How would you understand that? Do you think that they were looking at Jesus and thinking, you're the Christ, you're the Son of God, you're going to deliver people from sin? All right, he was going to come, and he was going to, in their minds, throw off the yoke of Roman bondage, and they were going to finally be free from that oppressive power. Since that redemption, the freeing is described with ongoing action, I would say that there had been a continuing desire about Jesus ridding the Hebrews from Roman control. So you have all these hopes about Jesus, and you have this intense discussion. Now as they're explaining this to the Lord, they say, it's been how many days? It's been
3 days.
So, again, we don't know for sure. I wonder a little bit if they hadn't been discussing this before the third day. So maybe this has sort of reached a pinnacle now. But we do know that they specifically mentioned some information about Jesus being crucified, verse 21. And then they also mention the women. That's interesting. They talk about how there were certain women from their company. So whoever these people were, Cleopas and the guy who's with them, they had some knowledge of at least some of Jesus' disciples. And he said these women, they went to the tomb when? They went when it was
very early
in the morning. And they had what kind of report?
He wasn't there.
Well, is there anything else in verse 22?
They saw angels that said he was alive.
Okay. I thought we had something else there. Women of our company, what did they do? They
did not find the body.
Okay. Do you have something like the word amazed?
Astonished.
Okay, they astonished us, they amazed us, and that would have been the report that they gave. So they've got this vision of angels, and again, it's something that really surprises them. And then, as you go down to the next verse, Luke chapter 24 and verse 23, what else do they say? Jesus was
alive.
Then in verse 24, you find that some others, they also go to the tomb, they verify that Jesus' body was gone, and there was, at this point, universal agreement as far as Jesus' body not being in the tomb. It had gone somewhere, but people were not certain where it was. Now, the Lord knew, obviously, all the things that these men had to say to him, and he immediately refers to these men in a very striking way. He calls them, first of all, what? You are 25. You're foolish men. And then what's he say? You're also slow of heart. Let's talk about those words for just a minute. The word foolish meant slow of heart, and one source said conveys the ideas of lacking understanding, of being thoughtless. This is not a term of contempt. It's not the term that you find over there where Jesus said don't refer to people as fools in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 22. It is a word which is applied to both believers and unbelievers. For example, in the book of Galatians, Galatians chapter 3 and verse 1, Paul said, "You foolish Galatians," same word. And then in Titus chapter 3 and verse 3, Paul talks about the fact that before Christians, he and others had been foolish as far as their behavior. Then you have the second word, which is translated slow in a lot of versions. It means that these men were not only unreceptive mentally, that they were equally unreceptive and unperceptive spiritually. Can you imagine how Jesus must have felt? I mean, you've just done the most incredible thing. You've been raised from the dead, you've suffered, you paid the full price for sin. And here you meet up with these guys, and they've got the wrong understanding, which is in some respects understandable, but they're thinking in physical terms, just like some people had before, and they're thinking, well, the third day has come, and you know, the body's somewhere. Obviously, they didn't believe that he had been raised from the dead, and they're just not getting it. How would you feel? Yeah, I think you would want to just grab the guys by the shirt collar and say, "Hey, fellas, and Jesus finally has enough," referring to them as foolish and slow of heart, probably got their attention. So Jesus, again, you begin to see the great love, the great patience that he has for people. Those are good lessons for us as we think about living the Christian life today. And he says, look, let's go back and think about all that the prophets had spoken about the Lord. Now you have two things going on here. You have both the prophetical passages and the information about Moses. So you could go back as early as Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, Genesis 49 and verse 10, the scepter, Jesus talked about not departing until Shiloh came, information in Numbers, Deuteronomy, Psalm 110. But then you can also turn to a number of the prophets, Isaiah and Daniel and Malachi and so forth. And Jesus says, look, it behooved the Christ to suffer in many ways and then enter into his glory, Luke 24 and verse 26. So he goes back to Moses, he goes back to all the prophets and starts laying this stuff out. Now, do you think that he goes to every single passage in the Old Testament and gives them a presentation about it? No. I mean, that would have probably taken far, far longer. Remember, we've been talking about Paul, and Paul gets instructed for about 3 years in Arabia. So I don't think that Jesus was able to take care of all of this. But he does begin from Moses, uses the prophets to show some information about God wanting to save man. Before his identity is made known, Jesus, the Bible says, he interpreted to them the scriptures. The word all is used. I think that means in a comprehensive way. One source pointed this out, and I think it's a good observation. He said, the books of Moses, Genesis through Deuteronomy, foretell Christ largely in types. We've talked about that several times, types being things like how Jesus was similar to the Passover, the rock in the wilderness, the sacrifice of Isaac, the Day of Atonement, and so forth. But when you deal with the prophets, it's not so much the types there. It's, for example, you think about Isaiah 53, you know, he's going to be this and this and this. The prophets, from one perspective, become a lot more specific. compared to the types that you find in the books of Moses and other parts of the Old Testament. So you have, moving down to verse 28 in Luke chapter 24, the Lord and these two men, they're getting near the village of Emmaus. And Jesus is acting as if what's going to happen? These fellows have come to their destination for the day, and what's the Lord going to do? He's going to keep going. Well, if you've had this fella who has interrupted your discussion, you probably thought it was a pretty lively discussion, but this guy is starting to unfold the scriptures in ways that you've never heard before. It's kind of like, what do you want? We want to hear you some more, so we would like you to stay with us. It's getting late. Luke 24 and verse 29, Jesus does go in. You have the evening meal. That's in Luke chapter 24 and verse 30. Jesus breaks bread, he blesses it, and he distributes it. Now, you have sometimes some good-hearted people who say, well, this was the Lord's Supper. I don't think so. I think that's really putting some information there that's not there. It seems to me that this was a common meal. So after this, the men have their eyes open, and they knew that they were with Jesus. That's Luke chapter 24 and verse 31. And once that happens, they realize who it is in the midst. Where does the Lord go? We don't know. He disappears. He vanishes. The disappearance of Jesus causes these men to reflect on what had happened. And again, it's an unusual statement. They said what had happened with their hearts. As he's with them, as he's expounding the scripture, he says, our hearts burn within us. You think they had heartburn? All right, it's not that they had heartburn. It's not a literal burning. What do you think is being described there?
Their zeal.
All right, I think you can tie that in there. One source defined this as to glow with warmth. You can think of what Teresa mentioned earlier. This is passionately felt emotion. That is, there is this understanding that's taking place. If you've ever studied the Bible with someone, whether it's a Christian or whether it is someone, maybe you, you've been in a Bible class or maybe you've heard a sermon, and it just clicked with you in some ways where it's just one of those experiences. And you walk out of that class, you walk out of that sermon, you walk out of that study, and you think, wow, the light bulb has really come on for me. I get it. I finally understand this. It never dawned on me before, and that's kind of what's taking place with these guys. They were amazed when Jesus began to open the Old Testament scriptures. Within an hour of the Lord's disappearance, this is verse 33, these fellows, they return to Jerusalem, they find the 11, and not only do they find the 11, verse 33 says what? And, well, is there anything else there? Yeah. Who were the ones who were with the apostles? I don't know. Who might have been with the 11? Yeah, I think, you know, here again, the ladies may have been hanging out with the apostles. All right, they tell them that the Lord had returned from the dead and he had appeared to Simon. That would be Peter, Luke 24 and verse 34. They rehearsed the things, Luke 24 and verse 35. That word literally means exegeted. When we talk about exegeting a Bible passage, we're talking about going in there and unfolding it, trying to take out everything that we possibly can. Now, if they're making this trip after dark, and that to me seems to be indicated by Luke chapter 24 and verse 29. They've come to their spot. It's the end of the day. Darkness seems to be prevalent. You think they had any nice flashlights? No. I'm not sure that they had anything to fend off robbers. So even though it may not have been the best time of day to go because of robbers and because of limited abilities as far as seeing in the night, was this information important enough to share? Share on the same day? Yes. So that seems to me to be what they were doing. So they go, they tell the people who are with the apostles, plus the apostles, verse 36, about what they had experienced. The previous reports had not gone so well, but now the apostles were getting information, not from women, but now from two men.